Good morning. My name is Sarah Turgeon, and I am a professor of psychology and neuroscience here at Amherst College. And this morning I have the pleasure of introducing one of our distinguished honorees this year, Dr. Robert Brown, Amherst class of 1969. Dr. Brown is one of our most distinguished alumni in medicine and biomedical research. In addition to prodigious research accomplishments focusing on motor neuron disease and neuromuscular diseases, particularly amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, he is a compassionate physician who takes care of patients suffering from ALS and other diseases involving muscles and control of movement. He is currently director of the Day Neuromuscular Research Center, the Muscular Dystrophy Association Clinic, and the ALS Therapy Alliance, all at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. He is also professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. However, as of October, Dr. Brown will be assuming the chair of neurology at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, where he will be working with gene therapy experts to develop new therapies to silence disease genes. After graduating from Amherst in 1969 with a major in biophysics and magna cum laude honors, Bob Brown received his medical training at Harvard Medical School and then went on to earn a doctor of philosophy at Oxford. He returned to the U.S. after obtaining his degree from Oxford and has been in the Harvard system ever since, first as a neurology resident and then faculty member in the neurology department, moving up to the position of full professor in 1998. His curriculum vitae lists numerous honors, including election to the selective and prestigious Institute of Medicine in 2001. He is author or co-author of more than 200 publications, not counting invited chapters and reviews, in the most distinguished scientific journals, including Science, Nature, and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In addition to contributing through his own research, Dr. Brown has been instrumental in setting directions for the larger research effort to conquer neurological disease through his work with charitable organizations such as Project ALS and Cure ALS Initiative, and is a member and chair of NIH study sections. Most biomedical researchers make contributions to understanding one disease or a group of related diseases, but Dr. Brown has worked productively on many different diseases with the common theme that they affect muscles and movement. His accomplishments include showing that mutations in muscle ion channels cause hyperkalemic periodic paralysis and collaborating with others in the seminal discovery that mutations in the gene for superoxide dismutase cause some forms of familial Lou Gehrig's disease. In addition, he has contributed to our understanding of the ataxias, muscle myopathies and dystrophies, and sensory neuropathies. Another Amherst alumnus who works in this field, Dr. Reggie Fratin, class of 1981, and director of the Burke Medical Research Institute, has called Brown, quote, a giant in the field of translational research. An alumnus who also works in the neurology department at Harvard, Dr. Matthew Frosch, class of 1978, has noted Bob Brown's dedication to helping patients with these difficult diseases, a side of his career that does not show up in publications and honors, but is noteworthy for someone whose research and achievements might have been expected to consume his entire professional life. As if he weren't busy enough, Dr. Brown recently made time to return to his alma mater in the spring semester of 2007 as a guest professor in Professor Stephen George's Neurobiology of Disease course. He lectured and led class discussions on channelopathy diseases and ALS. Personally, I am keenly aware of the importance of Dr. Brown's work, as my father, who is Amherst class of 1964, was diagnosed with ALS 2 years ago. Ironically, just last weekend, in fact, right about now, I was sitting on the stage of the commencement at my alma mater, Kenyon College, where my father has been professor for 36 years in the drama department, where I was receiving on his behalf an honorary degree commemorating his retirement, as he was unable to attend the ceremony. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Brown.
Thank you so much, Dr. Turgeon, for this very kind introduction. I also want to express my gratitude to President Marks and the trustees for honoring me this weekend. I'm grateful to Pat Allen, who has coordinated our schedules so effectively and welcomed us so warmly. And I want to say that it really has been a great pleasure for me to reconnect with Amherst recently through Professor George and to have the opportunity to come back and participate in the Neurobiology of Disease course last year. As Dr. Turgeon mentioned, I graduated from Amherst nearly 40 years ago and completed my graduate education by 1975. And as I compare the world that I entered then with the world that the class of 2008 is entering now, I'm struck by a defining difference in the way the medical science that we now see around us is practiced. To put it briefly, medical science has, in effect, gone global. And for the next few minutes, I'd like to reflect on this difference. My theme is a revised version of Thomas Friedman's idea that the world is flat. Just as social changes have flattened the economic world, it's very clear that seismic changes such as the web and the Genome Project have leveled and even democratized the world of biomedical science. So let me say first that, above all, I am a clinician. As you've heard, I run a large clinic for patients who have neurological diseases, like muscular dystrophy or motor neuron diseases, that cause weakness and typically lead to profound disability and very often to death. Most of these diseases are untreatable, so in the largest sense, my task basically is to try to confer dignity and autonomy on these individuals and even hope in the face of impending death. But I can tell you that in ways that we have never predicted, our clinical activities now turn out to have global dimensions. And perhaps most obviously, the first is that because we are a specialty clinic, of course, we see patients from all over the country and from around the world. That in itself is wonderful. But when they cannot come to us from abroad, we often can see patients via the web and conduct ongoing medical assessments and work with clinicians abroad to help manage such individuals. It's amazing that while the internet, of course, can never take the place of a face-to-face interaction or a hands-on examination, one can really monitor health status of these folks really quite well through the web and web-based resources. And our clinical practice has gone global in another sense, in that we now outsource many of our vital but routine clinical activities. And as you probably know, the radiologist who evaluates your x-ray when you go to your local emergency room at 2 in the morning is just as liable to be in Bangalore as in Boston or the Bronx. In parallel with the clinical activities, I also run a research laboratory that studies these neuromuscular diseases with the long-term goal of trying to understand them and, of course, ultimately to treat them. And I can tell you that in that capacity, I wear many hats. Of course, one function in the lab is doing science itself, studying the diseases, trying to keep up with current concepts and technologies, and running the science enterprise. But it's also the case that a major activity that I am almost continually engaged in is fundraising, essentially keeping the resources available to keep the lab going. Through diverse mechanisms that involve the federal government, private agencies, and even wonderful individual benefactors. And I would say that to a degree that I certainly never anticipated when I left Amherst, most of us in this kind of biomedical research really are entrepreneurs, in the sense that we have collaborations and projects, which are our products, and we then market these or sell these to funding agencies, patients, and consumer groups in a way that really is extremely entrepreneurial. And then finally, I'm a teacher, and in that capacity, I work with young scientists and with physicians in training to try to go to the clinic and translate clinical phenomenology into hypotheses that can be readily tested in the laboratory. So as you've heard, for many years, for 30 years in fact now, our primary research interest has been in Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. This is a dreadful disease that typically afflicts people in mid-adult life, usually in years of peak professional productivity. It's characterized by a process of death of motor neurons, which are very large cells that reside in the brainstem, and the spinal cord, and serve to connect the conscious and the unconscious brain to muscles, and thereby to execute all types of movement. And what one sees clinically in this disease is a process in which, very focally, some part of the body gets weak, either it's a hand or a foot, perhaps speaking, chewing, or swallowing. Then over 2 to 3 to 4 years, the process spreads subtly but relentlessly until there's complete paralysis. And unless one with this illness is put on a ventilator, this leads inexorably to death. So part of the issue here, which gets us back to neurobiology, is understanding the targeted cell type in the disease, the motor neuron. And I'll just say a few words about that because this has consumed much of my attention, and it's wonderful that, in fact, it's now part of the curriculum here at Amherst. The motor neurons are extraordinary cells. They are among the largest cells in the body. So they're cells that have an enormous diameter, unlike almost any other cell. But what's striking is that the great mass in the motor neuron is not in the large cell body. It's actually in a highly polarized process called an axon that emanates from the cell body to project to muscle. And something like 90, 95, 99% of the whole mass of the cell is actually out in this enormously long process. In fact, the analogy I like to use is the following. If this lecture hall here were a motor neuron, say, in the low part of my back, extending its process down to a toe muscle, my foot 3 feet away roughly, in fact, this lecture hall-sized motor neuron would have an axon that ran down to Manhattan. So it's just an enormous anatomy. It's implausible. And what makes it even more implausible is that this is a type of cell that is born essentially with a very limited capacity to regenerate. So once it sends this process out and connects with muscle, it has minimal capacity after injury to regrow the process. And in fact, if some here, some people in the room, I'm sure, do this, if you know systems design, you would probably agree that this is a terrible systems design. Right? First of all, you make one cell instead of a lot of little ones. Secondly, they can't repair themselves. And one guesses that part of the reason this situation is as it is that this cell type evolved when we, as a species, were expected only to live 25 or 30 years, and not, Lord willing, 60, 70, or 80. But the fundamental question, nevertheless, then remains, why is it that after 40 or 50 years, the power switch gets turned off in this cell and slowly it involutes and dies? And I might add that this is the same question that arises in the context of Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, Huntington's, any brain degenerative disease, in which subsets of neurons slowly undergo involution and death. And so, of course, one of our ancillary hopes is that any insights that are garnered in terms of ALS might play out and be helpful in these other diseases, and reciprocally. So when we embarked on this work in the mid-1980s, there were very few plausible hypotheses about how a disease like this can occur. But we did know that about 10% of the cases arise because of inherited gene defects, and a pattern that suggested that one needs only one abnormal gene to trigger the disease. So one of the questions then was, could one find a way to go after those genetic forms and look at them as a keyhole through which you might view all of the forms? And it was very fortunate that in the mid-1980s, a remarkably powerful tool became available to allow one to track down genes in families, a tool that really anticipated the power of the Genome Project and led to the identification of many, many disease-causing genes during the late 80s. In the early 90s, and you will recall the great discoveries, for example, in cystic fibrosis and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. They all used these kinds of techniques. And the technique is basically fairly simple. What it involves is looking at normally occurring variants in DNA that are spaced all along the 3 billion base pairs of DNA that make up our genome, and asking a simple question. If we have a large family in which some people have the disease and some don't, can we find DNA variants that are only seen when the disease is present? And if you find that kind of correlation, you know that that DNA variant resides in a neighborhood in the genome which has to be near the disease-causing gene. So if you find the variant and you find the correlation, then you can hone in and figure out what the gene is. It's a little bit, for example, like trying to find essentially a burning house by looking first from a satellite, where with a Google image, you might see a little tiny plume of smoke. But if you then fly over with an airplane, you can figure out, is it in the northeast? What state is it in? What town is it in? And then you can track down, of course, the street and ultimately the burning house. So that's a little bit what like gene linkage is like. So the issue then becomes, how can we generate enough collections of families that are large enough to do this kind of technology? And I can tell you that ALS itself is pretty rare, which is a big problem in terms of getting funding for research in this country. But familial ALS is even rarer. So the way we dealt with that then was in this pre-web era to simply write letters to hundreds and hundreds of neurologists all around the United States, Europe, South America, and ask them, do you have families where this disease runs over many generations? And I'm just delighted to say that, in fact, many clinicians who are incredibly busy found time to go through their records and get us information on such pedigrees. So that by the late 1980s, we had collaborators from the U.S., Canada, England, Scotland, Belgium, France, Israel, Sweden, Saudi Arabia, and more recently we have wonderful collaborators from Turkey, Mexico, and China. And as you might imagine, this set of collaborations has been just incredibly rewarding. For one thing, as you can clearly predict, this has led to wonderfully close and enduring friendships with these investigators. So they opened not only their clinical records, but their hearts and their homes. Often when we visit these families, we stay with these physicians. And reciprocally, they come to see us. It's also been a source of research fellows, so we've had perhaps 25 or 30 research fellows from abroad who come and spend 2 or 3 years in the laboratory to help study not only our families, but theirs as well. And then, of course, perhaps the most important point is that these collaborations have led to scientific insights and the identification of many gene defects that cause not only ALS, but other neurological diseases as well. And what we think is that knowledge of these defects is beginning at least to give a glimmer of hope that we may be able to understand some of the cascades of events that lead to a disease like ALS. How is it that one single base pair that gets changed out of these 3 billion can reside silently in the genome for 30 or 40, 50 years and then trigger a process which, like falling dominoes, leads first one and then 100 and then 100,000 cells to die? So let me just give you some brief examples of how this has played out. So from Leuven in Belgium, there was an enormous family in which it had been published in the literature that over many generations, half of every generation had Lou Gehrig's disease. And it was that family more than any other that led us and our collaborators in 1993 to find mutations in a protein antioxidant called superoxide dismutase, as you've heard, can trigger one form of Lou Gehrig's disease. It turns out that this protein is expressed in every cell in the body, and it's expressed in every organism on the face of the earth. So it's really important for detoxifying free radicals that we all generate as a consequence of breathing oxygen to survive. But indeed, its mutation leads selectively to motor neuron disease. From Tunis in North Africa, another family highlighted the presence of a protein, which we and others called ALSIN, that signals several steps in the process whereby an axon grows out, finds its pathway, and connects to muscle. And a family in Alabama led us to identify an amazing gene called Dynactin, which is like a V8 engine, like a diesel engine, that sits on top of an axon and carries cargoes back and forth from the cell body here in the lecture hall to the distal terminal, wherever it may be. So, of course, this has all been very exciting and has, again, begun to define pathways that we think may be incriminated in this disease process. And it's been helpful in other ways. So, for example, again, because of new technologies, it's extremely exciting that if you have a mutation in a gene that acts to trigger cell death, you can very often take that and put it into an animal model and create an animal model of the same disease. So one of the things that others did shortly after the first ALS gene was defined was to take that gene defect and put it in a mouse, of all things, in the germline of a mouse, so that in fact it turned out that the mice then went on to develop adult onset, first focal and then spreading motor neuron disease, and to die of a disease process that looked incredibly like, eerily like our patients in the clinic. And there are now rat models, there are worm models, there are fruit fly models, there are even fish models of these diseases, which are powerful. They're powerful in part because, as you can imagine, you can take them apart. You can dissect them, you can look at the molecular biology of the disease in a way that is would, of course, be unimaginable in a human. You can also use them to test drugs. You can test a drug in a mouse in 6 months for a thousandth the cost of a full trial in a human, for example. You can also take the genes and put them into petri dishes and recreate small elements of the disease, in dishes that are so small that in a plate this size you might be able to do a test of anywhere from 300 to 400 different drugs. And the petri dish assays can typically be done in 24 hours. So that, of course, enormously at least accelerates the drug discovery process. So what I would say is that the benefits, then, of our interactions with so many of these wonderful collaborating clinicians have been palpable. And while we don't have a treatment yet, at least we have some ideas about where to go. There are now 26 drugs queued up in the pipeline for clinical trial in humans. But I thought I'd share just one or two or three other quick lessons that we've learned from this process, because I think these are perhaps obvious, but at least are compelling. One lesson which I've learned again and again is that the human body has a limited repertoire of behaviors and responses to disease. So that if you go to Riyadh or Lima and see someone who's dying of ALS, the whole process of weakness, the indignity of disability, the pain of shortness of breath, and the agony of the death itself is exactly the same for the patients and the family as it is in Amherst or anywhere else. On the other hand, it's also instructive to see that there are some diseases with unique features that you only see in certain parts of the world because of cultural issues. So that, for example, in some parts of the world, first cousin intermarriage is promoted, which means that in those regions, one has an opportunity to see recessively inherited diseases of a type that we never or rarely see here. So, for example, in the ALS form that we see in Tunis, incredibly, the disease starts at about the age of 5 or 6 or 7 years of age, very early, and that's terrible, of course. But the good news is it has a very long course, so the people who get that disease survive 20 or 30 or 40 years. I would mention parenthetically that another lesson that has been reinforced in every medical field trip abroad that I take is the uniqueness of the infrastructure for biomedical research here in the United States. The concept that's espoused here is that someone can be a clinician seeing patients with a disease and also run a laboratory and somehow bring these two activities coherently together. And I can tell you that you see this concept to some degree in Western Europe, but it does not exist anywhere else in the world. One of the reasons it exists here, of course, is that we are blessed by having an extraordinary Institute of Health, which spends something like $26 or $27 billion a year on biomedical research, including spending on many mechanisms exactly to bridge this chasm between clinical worlds and laboratory investigations. And I'll also note that our tax structure, to a degree I never appreciated when I started traveling, promotes philanthropy and makes it possible for very wealthy people to benefit by giving their money to private endeavors like medical school research programs. Again, you just don't see this in even Western Europe. This is quite extraordinary. And the point of this comment is not only to laud our system, but in a sense to argue that we need to protect it and do the best we can to make sure that the system remains intact in the face of sometimes competing and adverse alternate use of resources. So the final point I want to emphasize is that, as we all know, over the last 5 years, this process of gene tracking has been accelerated beyond any of our expectation by, of course, the completion of the Genome Project. So we know that in 2003, the entire sequence of all the DNA molecules of human beings was completed and published. Probably the most extraordinary science project in the last 50 years, perhaps the equal of the discovery of the theory of relativity or the double helix. And I think it's a testament to the egalitarian view of the planners of the Genome Project that virtually all of the data it has generated has been put on the web where it's freely available to anyone. Literally anyone in the world who has a laptop PC and an internet link can download the entire genomes now not only of humans, but of many, many other species, as well as all the appropriate software to analyze them. So it's not surprising, again, to quote Thomas Friedman, that it may be that the next great breakthrough in biomedical science will come from a 15-year-old in Egypt who has a powerful laptop. I hope that's the case. For those of us in the lab, the immediate consequence, of course, is that we now can do the kind of work I've just outlined to you far more rapidly than ever before. We have an unprecedented tool set for these sorts of research projects. We're now heavily engaged, just to give you one more twist on this, with colleagues from 5 different countries trying to find gene variants that predispose not to familial Lou Gehrig's disease, but to sporadic disease, and maybe even that affect how rapidly it progresses or where it starts in the body. We have a collection of more than 5,000 DNA samples in this analysis, and this is just one example of how one can use this new type of genetic information. Critics of the Genome Project hold a reductionist view that this repository of genetic information somehow relegates humans to a set of predetermined sets of states and behaviors devoid of free will. I think the point those of us in medical research make is that you can view alternately the genome database as a kind of gargantuan library that's a testament to human diversity and to unpredictability and changeability of humans. And certainly, of course, it's a phenomenal tool for discovery in medicine. So perhaps the most important point I can make in conclusion is that these are really exhilarating times to be in biomedical research. Between the web, which has truly transcended national and academic boundaries and has bypassed many language barriers, and the Genome Project, new consortia for research have just unprecedented resources for this kind of biomedical discovery. This is true in my own domain of research. It's true across medicine. And to any of you in the room who may be graduates embarking on careers in this brave new medical world, I think one can predict with very, very high confidence that you will have novel opportunities that are intellectually engaging, scientifically very, very rewarding, and even aesthetically gratifying, all of which make this a most promising field for endeavor. There's no doubt that the result will be accelerated progress in trying to understand a realm of human diseases like ALS and ultimately to alleviate the corresponding suffering. Thank you again for your attention. It's a great honor to be here. I'd be delighted to try and thank you. Sort of obvious limitations, although in general the system works reasonably well. The most obvious, of course, is that there are competing uses for our tax dollars. So the federal government, which really, I mean, this NIH is really extraordinary and has a level of funding for research that you just don't see, even in the UK, for example. But obviously, to be blunt, with the war and other sort of national budgetary items, the pay line for research over the last 2 to 3 years has dropped dramatically. You know, we meet in a committee that I chair at the NIH 3 or 4 times a year to review grants which people pour their hearts into. You know, they spend months preparing these grant proposals, and we will look at 50 of them over a 2.5-day orgy in a darkened room somewhere, and maybe 5 of them now will get funded, or 4. So the pay line is just below 10%. So that's a big limitation in terms of research momentum. The others are also sort of obvious. Even within the world of medical research, there are competing needs, and so orphan diseases like Lou Gehrig's tend to fare fairly badly in terms of the whole pie chart of dollars spent. And then the third one, which is again obvious, is that for this reason I just mentioned, Big Pharma typically only wants to invest in diseases where there's a robust market share. So, and there are some exceptions, but what's also wonderful is that we have a flourishing biotech industry here with very, very creative people fueled by entrepreneurial capital dollars who are taking some very novel ideas in orphan disease settings and pushing them forward. And what's interesting is that I think the real gruel that's going to allow Big Pharma to expand is not its own internal research. It's going to be buying biotechs that have done the creative research on risky dollars. So those are 3 issues that I think are important.
Just to follow up, the government is not so good at delivering our mail or water bottles to people in need in a hurricane. How can the NIH be an exception to that? What is it really that good, and why is it different?
Yeah, I'm coming across a little bit like a defenseman or an apologist for the NIH, and I hadn't quite planned it this way. But for one thing, for better or for worse, it's an enormous bureaucracy, and so it has a tendency, sort of like the bureaucracy that runs our British government, to be immune to changes in the White House. And so programs that are put in place that have a 5 or an 8 or a 10 year lifespan tend to endure, albeit with some variations in total dollars, independently of who's in political favor at the moment. It's a remarkably egalitarian organization. I mean, it goes out of its way to essentially dissociate all potentially biasing financial relationships with anything in the private sector, be it Big Pharma or other groups. And I think for those reasons, has managed to remain pretty objective and pretty steadfast in its overall design and program, its so-called roadmap.
Somehow
I survive. I'll leave it at that. Thank you for. Why do you ask?
Because you said last night that you won't get your first paycheck until later this year.
Yeah. Different institutions have different ways of paying their investigators. Some are more entrepreneurial than others. Again, I'll leave it at that.
What are some of the most promising experimental therapies for ALS?
Yeah, I think there are several, and some of these, again, are kind of obvious. So for those of us who look at these familial forms of disease, where we know that the presence of, if you will, a toxic or a killer protein is actually what causes the problem, what one would like is some way to reduce the burden of that toxic protein in cells. And what's, I think, incredibly exciting are both old and new technologies that are now allowing one to go in and turn off the sick gene. So there's an old technology that's been around for 25 years called antisense oligonucleotides that will potentially do that. There's a new one called inhibitory RNA, for which a Nobel Prize was just given 2 years ago, which will also do that. And just to give you one example, it's now been shown that in these ALS mouse models, if one infuses those reagents, either the old one or the new one, into the spinal fluid that bathes the spinal cord, one can achieve enough of a shutdown of the protein and reduction of its levels to actually extend the life of these mice longer than had previously been possible. So just to give you one example, we're very excited now about trying to do that in the patients who have these forms of disease. Now, admittedly, that's just one part of the pie, but it's a start, and I think a very important start. There are many other things, and I'll just tell you briefly that one, for example, is the use of gene therapy to deliver growth factors to the nervous system. Still in its infancy, but some promising early results. And then the tools for this sort of higher throughput drug discovery have got better and better. Big gamble, but potentially fruitful. Certainly a gamble worth taking, I would think. So, yes, sir.
Any differences between men and women?
In this disease? There are some differences. So one of the things that has been known for a long time is that in the non-inherited forms of the disease, the ratio of males to females is almost 2-to-1. So gender clearly makes a difference. That's up until the time of the age, basically, of 55 or 60. After that period, whether that's because of the influence of menopause or something else, it's a 1-to-1 ratio. So there is a difference, and I would say we don't understand that. There are other differences. If one looks, for example, at motor nerves that project to the eyes or to the bowel and bladder, they are immune to this disease, whereas motor neurons that are only 2 centimeters away get the disease. So within the neural axis of each patient, there is an answer to the disease if we're smart enough to break it down and decode it. So these differences are actually very, very important to study. Yeah.
Yes. You mentioned the connection between these various diseases where subsets of neurons die. Yeah. Do you have examples where ALS work has helped MS or Alzheimer's?
Yeah, we don't. So I'll start right out by saying that because ALS work has not led to any therapy thus far, I can't substantiate that claim. But I can say that the insights that have come from the analysis of molecular events in the cells as they die turn out to have many common features. So, just to give you a couple of examples, it's clear that in most of these diseases, one of the major problems in the cell is aberrant folding or unstable behavior proteins, which then get clumped or aggregated and then in one way or another confound the body's, if you will, protein garbage disposal system so that other proteins can become abnormally either clumped or metabolized. And that kind of theme looks like it plays out over all these diseases. Another theme is that, for example, mitochondria, which make energy in the cells, turn out to be defective, albeit in different ways, in most of these diseases. And there are still other commonalities, but thus far, because none of these have been substantially treated, we can't give you a good example of the crosstalk.
Do anybody try stem cells?
Yes. So the world of stem cells is, I debated whether or not to put that in my comments. It's clearly going to have an enormous impact. And so the science fiction view, which may not be so much fiction or science anymore, we'll have to see, is that one ought to be able to take stem cells and convert them into precursor cells for the types of neurons that die in these diseases, put them in the brain or the spinal cord, and replenish the missing population of cells. And, when you see someone who's got fairly advanced Lou Gehrig's, it could be argued that the only therapy that will ever recover lost function will be to replace missing motor neurons. And while that is a kind of visionary statement, in fact, I wouldn't rule that out at all, and that may be something 8, 10, 12 years down the line that will be quite important. But stem cells have already proven important in other senses. So just in the last year, for example, it's been shown that one can take a very primitive stem cell, let's say from an ALS mouse, and turn it into a motor nerve on the one hand and supporting cells, so-called glial cells, on the other, put them together in a dish and study how they interact together. Are they supportive? Are they adverse? What's the nature of the interaction? And how can you use that to think about therapy? So that's already happening. It's very, very exciting. Even more exciting, reports just within the last 6 months that you can take a skin cell from a patient with any disease and by manipulating the nucleus in the cell, turn that skin cell into a stem cell. And what that means is that whether we're talking about Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or ALS or Huntington's or anything, you can take a skin biopsy from a patient and in 6 months be studying that patient's motor nerves in a petri dish. And so you will have, for the first time, the ability to look at the behavior of the cell in the full genetic context of the patient who has the disease. And you can then look at diversity of effects of different genetic contexts on the behavior of the cell, as well as, of course, a variety of therapeutic implications. So when we talk about stem cells, there are many senses in which that whole world of new biology is going to make an enormous difference.
And autoimmune is not
involved? Autoimmune processes? So for some diseases, like someone mentioned multiple sclerosis, it's clear that there is a sort of flagrant activation in the immune system that participates in a major way in accelerating the whole disease. We don't know the degree to which that's true in most of these degenerative diseases. 10 years ago, I would have said, no involvement at all. But now I can tell you that it's very clear that in any of these, there is a process of subtle, what we call neuroinflammation. So there is activation of components of the immune system. The degree to which they participate in the disease is not clear. There's a kind of cell called a microglial cell, for example, which clearly can accelerate the disease, but we don't know yet with what impact or how to manipulate that usefully. That's a good question.
Okay. In animal models, is there any factor in the disease that can be transferred from an older diseased animal to a younger animal?
Yeah.
In other words, can a diseased neuron affect new, healthy neurons?
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. So the short line answer is not that I know of. There's one report from 1962 from a man named Zilba, I think it was, or Zilka in Russia, who said that he took ALS brains, ground them up, and injected the material into rabbits and produced ALS in rabbits. And I can tell you that many labs have spent hundreds of thousands of your tax dollars trying to reproduce that without success. So the notion there's a propagatable, quote-unquote, infectious or propagatable element has not been borne out.
And that, in one sense, that's a promising thing, because if this is only affecting certain neurons, then the spread within a particular person or a particular animal, then is something happening in each one of those cells individually,
right,
as opposed to...
Right, right. I mean, what seems pretty clear to me is that, sort of like the domino model that I mentioned, that it's almost like there's a cellular contagion, which is that the cells may have a propensity to go down, but something triggers the start of the process, and in some way or another, perhaps through supporting cells, the process spreads almost like a toxic bloom. And you see that if you look at the pattern of spreading. So without getting too esoteric, if the disease starts in the right foot, it usually spreads to the left foot or the right arm, rarely from the right foot across the body to the left arm. And when you map out the anatomy, that suggests that there is some notion of a contiguous or spread among contiguously located populations of cells, which is still not to say that there's an infectious element so much as there's a propagatability within the nervous system once the disease starts. Yes, ma'am.
Can you test family members in familial ALS to see if they have the genes and they prevent?
So in settings where we know there's a positive family history and we know the disease-causing mutation in some of the affected individuals, we can then test others to see whether or not they have that mutation. And we are heavily engaged in that. We have now in our overall collection close to 700 families with ALS, and of course there are now hundreds and hundreds of offspring in those families who are at risk. And one of the reasons we care about this question about new interventions to turn off the genes is that clearly for half of all of those at-risk offspring, we need something that will allow us to go in and shut off the offending gene. But the short answer to your question is we can only know that when we know what the gene is in that family. And these strategies will only work when we can target that particular gene. So that's still pretty much early days. So.
start talking about spreading, and we know that, I presume we know it's not infectious, then that brings to mind prions.
Yes, absolutely.
What about that?
Yeah, so we have wondered about this prion disease model, the notion being that there are proteins that we all make, that every cell makes, which under certain circumstances can misfold, and in so doing trigger other proteins in the same family similarly to misfold. And so I will tell you that I don't think we have good tools now to test the prion-like model, and we've not fully applied them. So there's work to do there, and that model may be relevant. The one comment I make is that it's true that prion diseases can be propagated by animal-to-animal inoculation without testing material, and that at least has not happened in ALS. But the prion model, as a model, I think, has not been adequately explored. It's an extremely important question.
Does a person suspect they have ALS? How do they do that? How do you diagnose, or do you tell them?
So that harkens to another important point, which is that for any of these brain degeneration diseases, what we need, apart from gene mutation tests, are good markers, good so-called biomarkers, diagnostic markers that say the disease is here or it's not here. Or, by the way, they'll tell you how active it is. Because if you have a marker like that, you can try a drug and see if the marker gets better before the patient gets better. And that's very helpful in assessing the impact of a drug. Right now, to get to your question, the process of making a diagnosis is abysmally slow. So in 2008, the time interval from first symptom to definitive diagnosis in a specialist clinic is 14 months. And if the window for treatment is early on in the disease, it's pretty much closed then by the time we get to. So we have to do much, much better. So the way the diagnosis is done now is by excluding everything else. Is there a disc, for example? Is there a tumor? Is there an autoimmune nerve problem? Once those are all excluded and the clinical picture looks like Lou Gehrig's, then we make the diagnosis. So it's kind of primitive. And
so people just sort of give them the kiss of death. I mean, is that...
Well, so when the final diagnosis comes down, that strikes at the heart of what it means to be a clinician, frankly. Mm-hmm. Is it a kiss of death? Is it a hug of life? I mean, I'm not quite sure what you call it, but yes, you communicate a diagnosis which has just incredibly dire set of implications, and the question is how you deal with that. How do you share hope without being misleading and so forth? Mm-hmm. But yes, that's essentially what happens.
Yeah. You mentioned in discussing stem cells that it's now possible with recent discoveries to study a disease in the context of an individual's genome.
Yes.
Does that suggest that maybe the future treatment for ALS or other diseases might be tailored specifically to individuals? Or
absolutely.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I really expect that will be the case. We already know that that's the case in some cancers, for example, the terrible cocktails of sledgehammer drugs we give to suppress dividing cells can be now tailored and refined in ways that are much less injurious, have fewer side effects for cancer patients. And I find it very easy to believe that that will be the case for most of the neurodegenerative diseases. And already the notion that for the inherited forms you will use different forms of RNAi or antisense oligos for different forms suggests that, but I think it'll be a much more complicated but much more broadly applicable approach, as you're suggesting, down the line. You know, some will arise because of too much of one growth factor, some will have too little of another, some will have heightened sensitivity to copper or a metal, some will have heightened sensitivity to an insecticide. And depending on which category we can define, then the therapies will almost surely be different. Well, thank you again for your attention.